This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Have that chance now to check in on how the Indiana gaming industry is doing, so to speak. That's why we turn to the fellow who created and is the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters for the HANA News Service, Ed Feigenbaum. Ed, thank you for joining us in the program today.
Yeah, I always appreciate you having me on, Chris.
Well, I'm glad to have you a chance to at least bring us up to date on but first thing, I guess, the latest revenue numbers from the Indiana Gaming Commission. Have they started to bounce back, so to speak, from the closure because of the pandemic?
Well, I think you need to look at them in two different lights.
Okay.
One is absolute and one is relative. You know, absolute, we're not doing as well as we'd like to be doing. Relative to where we have been and where we could be going, I think we're doing okay. You know, the 13 casinos brought in about $170 million in revenue during the month of September, and that was down not only from September 2019, but it was effectively the lowest September win that we've seen since 2001. And that's not a good thing to have, of course. But in terms of where we could be, you know, where you might think that we would be, you know, given the capacity restrictions, given the limited number of slot machines on the casino floors, given the number of table games that are available, and given the restrictions on play at the table games, you know, with the plexiglass panels, the limitations on the number of players that can be there, and in particular for I think Horseshoe Casino Hammond, mm-hmm. some of the changes in type of play at some of the tables, like the Baccarat tables. You know, you can't have people over the shoulders of other people at the tables anymore under the new pandemic restrictions. And that used to be, you know, a really popular social thing at the Baccarat tables. And I think if you look at the Bach results in particular for September at Horseshoe, you'll see that this is having a particular impact. So there are a lot of different kinds of impacts that the pandemic is having. You know, a lot of people don't want to go because they don't want to wear a mask. People don't go because they can't get the drinks on the floor as easily as they might have been able to before, or, you know, eat or drink on the floor. And then, you know, this whole social trend that, you know, what we used to see with respect to some of these table games that you can no longer do is also seeming to have an impact on play at some of those particular tables.
When you mentioned about being very popular game at the Horseshoe Casino, is Baccarat at some of the other casinos, maybe elsewhere in the state, as popular? And are they suffering as well, what you can tell?
Well, interesting that you should ask. And listeners, I did not prompt Chris on that question, although I probably should have. The thing that made me explore that in a little bit more detail was the fact that for the first time that I could recall, Ameristar Casino East Chicago had actually seen an increase in Bach results to the point where they were over those of Horseshoe, and it seemed to be pretty unusual. And given that both properties were operating with new general managers, I kind of thought, well, maybe there's been a change in the way that the two casinos have decided to approach their Baccarat marketing, the way that they operate and organize those games. And when I dug a little bit deeper, I discovered that, you know, it really is the question of socialization. And I'm not quite sure why Ameristar particularly benefited in the month of September. But if you look at the overall, you know, Bach results, they are down.
I wonder if maybe Ameristar might have in some work, because they've had some renovation or some modernization aside from what everybody's had to do because of the pandemic, but they'd had some work earlier done. Do you think that maybe they'd made some adjustments and that maybe the remodeling or whatever that maybe Ameristar did might have been different than what the Horseshoe Casino might have had available?
Well, they definitely have. You know, they've been able to move some of their games out into the corridor between the boat and the hotel/pavilion.
Right.
And that certainly helped. But they market to different customers. And, you know, one of Horseshoe's big, I don't want to say advantages, but one of the things that they did a little bit differently than some of the other casinos was very aggressively market to the Chinese community, the Asian community in general on the south side of Chicago.
We mentioned the fact that the revenues have been down pretty much overall. And you also mentioned, too, about the boat capacity. And we'd looked at, I guess, wondered if that was something that you looked into in more detail, I guess, because of the pandemic, or was it just some change that had come about here?
Well, it's in part due to the pandemic, but I think that some of that some of the whole capacity issue is overrated to a certain extent. You know, there were very, very few times in recent pre-pandemic history in which any of the casinos were capacity limited. You know, they're all big enough, and there are enough gaming and other entertainment options in the Chicagoland area where it's not quite the novelty that it was when you had, you know, perhaps three boats open in Northwest Indiana and, you know, just a handful in the Chicagoland area, and you didn't have Rivers Casino open. The casinos had not been hitting their capacity limits before the pandemic, but it just makes it a little bit more difficult and more inconvenient for gamblers in this pandemic era to come in and gamble the way that they would like to. And some of the offerings are not there. You know, another thing that's limiting the attendance is the fact that poker rooms have been closed. And, you know, now that the Indiana Gaming Commission just last week said, hey, look, you know, we're inviting suggestions from the casinos to tell us how they might effectively, properly reopen the casino poker rooms, you know, given, you know, questions about social distancing and proper sanitation and things like that. The casinos are real excited because that seems to be the number one question that the players keep asking, you know, both in terms of their casino hosts and then on social media. You know, if you look at the Facebook pages for the different casinos, the big question is, when's your poker room coming back? Uh-huh. So, you know, there are different kinds of reasons that are keeping people from coming, but we really haven't had a problem with the true capacity limitations since the first weekend in June when the casinos reopened, and, you know, it was a big novelty, and there was a little bit of a built-up interest in gaming, but there's really not been a problem since the reopening.
Mm-hmm. While we're still on the subject of the Northwest Indiana casinos, and in particular the ones that are operating or going to be operating, have you gotten any new information on how they're doing with the new casino that is being built in Gary?
Oh, nothing more than everybody else is hearing. You know, it's in progress. You know, they're still looking at the same kind of timeline for opening as they were hoping for. You know, there may be a little bit of a regulatory snag, as everybody's heard, as a result of some difficulties that the former owners of what's now Majestic Star and Spectacle Entertainment LLC in the form of Centaur Gaming, which became Spectacle, you know, had. And that may prove to be a little bit difficult going forward, but I don't think that will have any impact on the casino opening, the casino itself opening physically. Mm-hmm. You know, there could be some different management or ownership options in order to allow that to happen, but I don't think that it will prevent the casino itself from physically opening on the schedule that the folks at Spectacle, Majestic Star, mm-hmm. Hard Rock have elaborated.
Now, bring us up to date, if you will. We may have to refresh our memories on the situation involving the former owners of Spectacle, the trouble that they're in, and all, I guess, tied into the fact there was a candidate running for a state office, for a legislative office, and it came up, I guess, all these names came suddenly in the news. What kind of impact, have you heard anything yet? I guess it must be running through the court system right now, I suppose.
Next question? No. this is really kind of an involved deal here, Chris, and I'll try and simplify it as best as I can. There's a federal law that says that you can't make campaign contributions in the name of another. So I can't give you $5,000 and say, hey, I want you to contribute this to candidate A. And there was an indictment filed in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana in Indianapolis late last month that alleges that Centaur Gaming and perhaps two of its executives, certainly one who was named, were involved in a scheme to funnel corporate money through some political consultants in Virginia and Maryland that were working for a state senator who is running in a congressional primary in southeastern Indiana in 2016. And that the consultants ended up, you know, essentially laundering about $35,000 or so in campaign contributions that would not have otherwise gone into this particular state senator's congressional race. And the everything's kind of coming home to roost now. There were some indictments in the Eastern District of Virginia, one of the courts that does a lot of the big federal, you know, federal government kinds of political cases back last year and then in January that kind of suggested that there was an unnamed Indiana gaming company and official involved. And now we're finding out that, yes, you know, this was the case and this indictment has come down. Now, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and it's kind of interesting how the indictment was phrased and how the press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office announcing it was phrased. And what we find out from that is that there is an FBI investigation that is continuing. And we also found out that the public integrity section of the U.S. Department of Justice was part of this indictment, which is pretty unusual for, you know, a Midwestern congressional, failed congressional candidate. And usually you only need the involvement sign off of the Department of Justice on something involving, you know, a sitting public official of some consequence. And the Justice Department was very, Justice Department in D.C. was very heavily involved in this particular investigation. The Gaming Commission came out and said, hey, you know, we've got some real concerns about some of the people that were implicated in this and their involvement with Spectacle, and we're going to investigate. And, you know, this raises questions about Spectacle, which was kind of unexpected for many of us to hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like obviously this is going to be things that we'll have to go through the courts and we'll see more later, although we just have opportunity, I guess, just with this happening relatively recently in the past month or so. It's not going to be coming up, I suppose, for any kind of resolution anytime soon, but they're certainly still going to look into this further. And it'll be interesting to see if it does have a better impact on Northwest Indiana than and just out of the course in Indianapolis. So, Ed, thank you very much for spending time and even spending time going through this last bit of information here. We'll have to watch for that and see what comes forth if we do see something. And thank you very much. And thank you very much for spending time to bring us up to date on how the Northwest Indiana casinos and the other casinos in the Hoosier State are doing. And we'll have you back on again soon.
We will look forward to it. Thanks for having me on, Chris.
You're welcome. Ed Feigenbaum is creator and editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters, and they're published by the Hanna News Service. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, summer has just gone by. We're into autumn now. Halloween is just around the corner. Pretty soon, we'll be looking at Thanksgiving and Christmas ahead. Well, despite all of the tumultuous events of 2020, it just seems that the year has raced on by. Maybe it's a little early, but it's still time for Americans to start thinking about some end-of-the-year financial moves. And for that, we turn to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer for some ideas. And Greg, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, give us an idea first as we've gone into this unprecedented year of law and policy changes, to be sure. What kind of special money considerations we need to really look at before it gets too late? Because there are deadlines we do have to meet.
Yeah, and there's several of them. One thing specifically related to the CARES Act was the opportunity to take a distribution up to $100,000 from your IRA or company plans and actually not be subject to the 10% early withdrawal. And, you know, there's ways to not only pay it back, but actually spread that income liability over a three-year period instead of just into the 2020 year. Go ahead.
I was going to say when you have this this deadline like this, is it something that maybe people that may have had an opportunity to do the distributions they wanted to do, or now have to certainly make their changes now to be able to keep the money that they haven't all spent completely, right?
Yeah, and I think specifically related to this one, just the caution that you want to have with it is, you know, there has to be the qualification under, you know, being impacted in some way by the coronavirus, either through loss of income, loss of wages, loss of job, whatever, you know, was a result of the pandemic. So you have to be specific around that. But there's still other areas that are just related to, you know, some of the recent tax law changes and some of the things that have become an opportunity because the CARE Act, you know, required minimum distributions were waived, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, someone might want to look at it and consider, given the current tax environment we're in, they still might want to take those distributions because tax brackets are lower than they've been historically.
One of the other things that we know that we face against deadlines, besides deciding whether I want to put that money back into the IRA or into the company retirement plan, is these minimum distributions that we've had an opportunity to deal with. Bring us up to date on those and what in turn we still have to do to be sure that we could be able to take advantage of everything and don't lose any money.
Yeah, I mean, the reason they waived the requirement of distributions is there was a huge impact on the market. So when you actually calculate required minimum distributions, it's based on the previous year's ending balance. So they made a provision to not require people to take it out. However, the market has recovered, and there may still be opportunities for people to utilize the tax brackets or do things along the lines of a charitable, you know, a qualified charitable distribution. And the QCDs are just a way to directly contribute or donate to some of your charities if you are in the required minimum distribution age. And it's actually goes back to the 70-and-a-half eligibility for everyone. If you're 70-and-a-half this year, you could actually make a qualified distribution directly to a charity and have it come off the top line and not be subject to the itemized deduction.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some end-of-the-year financial moves that we need to make, and because everything seems to be all mixed up here, thanks to the CARES Act, people have been able to stay financially afloat if they have been able to reach into their retirement savings to be able to do so. But some things you have to do before the end of the year to be sure. One of these others is this, we've talked before about, of course, are Roth IRAs, IRAs in general, traditional ones as they're called, and 401k funds. What were you thinking that we really need to do as to be able to meet this end of the year deadline?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to really understand whether or not Roth conversions would make sense given your individual situation. You know, federal tax rates are historically low, and they may not stay that way for long. You know, one, it is scheduled to revert back in the year 2025, but as we all know, you know, political changes and parties could, you know, increase or reduce the amount of time that you would have available under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to take advantage of these larger standard rate tables to consider conversions. And, you know, when doing it now, you're basically taking advantage of the opportunity of separating, you know, the tax liability in your traditional IRA by converting now in what we can argue might be the lowest tax rates we'll have around for a while, given, you know, the fact that we do need to start understanding how they're going to pay for a lot of the things that they provided in value through some of these stimulus packages that is just going to be debt that needs to eventually be paid.
Mm-hmm. One other point that we were talking about IRAs that we should need to bring up here is a way to be able to divide up your IRA if you wish to do so into separate accounts. What is that all about, and why is that one of the December 31st deadlines that we need to watch for?
Yeah, so part of the changes in the IRAs and, you know, limiting the stretch IRA and the opportunity to do that over a lifetime, you know, now being condensed down into 10-year requirement of distribution, it just increases the complexity of multiple beneficiaries and having the opportunity to do what they want versus a fellow beneficiary. And so the idea is if you split the IRAs and have each beneficiary direct they have more flexibility to do what they want with their individual IRAs. A lot of times when you have multiple beneficiaries on one IRA, you have to, it just increases the complexity of each individual wanting to accomplish either a 10-year payout, an immediate payout, and just having the allowance to do things specific to their situation, while it can still be done. Sometimes it's easier to take advantage of the opportunity to split them, and then they have time to establish their own separate inherited IRA accounts and act differently on different time frames based on their priorities and their concerns.
Now, it sounds like that if you take that move, if you decide to take the IRA and split it up into separate accounts, it isn't going to be a simple measure. It's going to take a little time. Is that because having to work with the financial institution or whoever happens to be holding the IRA, or is we're talking in this case about the Internal Revenue Service?
Well, I think it's the former. It's just basically logistically to get things done, you know, and anytime you're splitting or converting, you know, one of the things involved with a conversion, while it seems simple as an example, is you have to do the paperwork to open up the Roth account to actually convert to it, especially if you're not converting the whole thing. And similarly, you know, splitting an IRA is going to require, you know, separate accounts actually be established and created. So while it's all stuff that can be done and it's not something that necessarily is being held up by IRS in terms of can I or is it not possible, it's more or less, you know, internally with those individual companies, those custodians, you know, completing all the paperwork, finalizing the account registrations, and then ultimately, you know, dividing the assets that you the way you want to have them divided, and you just don't want to wait till the last few weeks of the year to do that.
I guess it'd be a case too that if the whatever financial plan that you happen to work with your IRA, if back at the home office, if they get a lot of these requests to split up, then it's going to take them a while to get all the paperwork done. So that's just going to make the process even longer.
Yeah, and that, and just the reality of it is, you know, if we end up with some type of, you know, restricted office work again due to a resurgence of the pandemic, and even without the pandemic, without the virus, you know, typically in December, hours are reduced, you know, at these different organizations because of the holidays. And to your point, you know, there's just a lot of people delay and put off to the very end to do distributions, conversions, and then you're adding on top of it splitting IRAs. A lot of people, because of that natural bent, you know, time of the end of the year is a deadline, you know, it usually increases the activity at the end, and why we encourage our clients to do all these type of maneuvers or planning or restructuring well in advance of December.
That's just wise to pay attention to the calendar and remember that the deadline is December 31st, the end of the year, to be sure. Well, Greg, thank you for the advice and the information, and we hope to have you back in soon.
Thanks, Chris.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The folks with the PNC Financial Services Group are planning a couple virtual economic briefings in the next few days. One of them is here in Northwest Indiana, and it's going to be with the chief economist of PNC Financial Services Group, Gus Fauché, and he is with us today to talk a little bit about what the clients here in Northern Indiana and the Chicagoland area, including Northwest Indiana, are going to hear about. And Gus, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, give us, if you will, first your take on these two private virtual meetings that are coming up with the local business owners, what it's going to involve over the next few days.
Yes. So I'll be presenting PNC's economic outlook, both for the United States, but also for the local economy. I'll be discussing where we think the economy will be going over the next year or two, and how the local economy is doing, how it's fared during the pandemic, and what we expect to see going forward.
What do you see are the business areas, the industrial areas that seem to have taken the biggest hits from the pandemic, especially when the real serious outbreak began this spring?
Yes, I think that the most severe effects have been for industries that deal with customers in person, not surprisingly, in large crowds, particularly the leisure hospitality services industry. So we saw huge declines in restaurant spending. We've seen huge declines in traffic at hotels and airline traffic. Obviously, there aren't many live sporting events, concerts, plays, those types of things happening. So it's basically those events, those industries communities where people gather in large crowds. Some of it is because of state restrictions, but some of it is also just because people are unwilling to go out and be in large crowds. And I think until we have a vaccine for the virus, that industry is likely to remain very weak going forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, what industries maybe seem to show the strongest rebounds?
Certainly, we've seen a huge increase in online sales. So because people aren't going out to brick-and-mortar stores as much, they're purchasing more online. That transition was already taking place, but it's accelerated with the pandemic. And that obviously has meant more business for trucking firms, for warehousing and distribution firms, and so forth. And so we are seeing strong growth in those industries, and then also, obviously, telecommunications. People are doing more virtual calls, virtual business meetings, and so the telecom industry has done very well also.
Does it seem that it's not all centered completely around Amazon, that maybe some of the other smaller players out there, just for example, all the pet lovers that take advantage of Chewy.com to get their pet food and the like for their kitties and their dogs?
That's right, and obviously, it's also those firms, those traditional retailing firms that already had a pretty extensive online presence. So you have firms that have both brick-and-mortar locations but also do online sales, and so they've seen some of their traffic switch from traditional stores to online. But it's not just – a lot of it's Amazon, but it's not just Amazon. And then it's also all of the associated industries with it, again. So mm-hmm. trucking, warehousing, distribution, right. They're all benefiting from that stronger online demand.
Now, we've talked about the strong rebounds. How about the weaker ones? You talked, of course, about the restaurant, the hospitality industry. Do they seem to be the ones that are the ones with the weakest rebounds right now?
Yes, we have seen traffic increase at restaurants. We have seen airline traffic increase. We have seen hotel traffic increase, but it's still far below where it was before the pandemic. I think people are still reluctant to go out and be in large crowds. I think restaurants are going to have a very difficult winter. Many of them have moved to outdoors, but right. That's going to become more and more difficult as the weather gets colder. And so I think that there are a lot of restaurants that are just hanging on and may face increasing difficulty as people remain unwilling to go out and be part of a large crowd.
And I guess the next question I have for you, Gus, is to find out at least your take on what kind of impact that the presidential election is going to have on the economy. And we know that even now we're still trying to negotiate through another set of fiscal stimulus plans, and it hasn't happened yet.
Yes, and so certainly I do think the economy does need more fiscal stimulus. I think that although consumers really have benefited from those one-time stimulus payments that many households received and then extra unemployment insurance benefits, those benefits have expired for many people. And I am concerned that with the unemployment rate still elevated, that a lack of fiscal stimulus could be a problem. I'm also concerned that there are many small and medium-sized businesses out there that are just barely hanging on. PNC just released a survey a week or so ago of small and mid-sized businesses. And it found that about a third do not expect that they can continue for more than a year in current economic conditions. So there are a lot of small and medium-sized businesses that are just hanging on. But they do need more fiscal stimulus. But in terms of the presidential election, I think that's secondary to the path of the pandemic. I think if we get the pandemic under control, then we will see a strong economic rebound. But if we get to mid-2021, late 2021, the virus is still out there, people are still uncomfortable being in large crowds, then I think that that's going to be a significant problem. And so I would expect that no matter who wins the presidency, the most important thing is containing the virus and making people feel comfortable about going out.
Now, Gus, in getting ready for the two virtual economic briefings that you're putting together, did you find anything interesting in doing your homework, so to speak, about Northwest Indiana?
There was a severe downturn in Northwest Indiana initially because a lot of the manufacturing facilities closed down.
Right.
So it's a heavy manufacturing industry, and initially those plants closed, and we saw big job losses. But since then, those plants have reopened, and in particular, there's been very strong demand for those types of consumer goods that are manufactured in Northwest Indiana. So automobiles and auto parts, recreational vehicles, and we've seen really strong demand bounce back in those areas. And so although the initial contraction was pretty severe in northwest Indiana, the rebound has been pretty strong. And in fact, we've seen the unemployment rate decline much more quickly in northwestern Indiana than in other parts of the United States.
Well, Gus, thank you for spending time with us to talk about not only the regional look, but also a little broader look as well for the economic outlook, and something that the folks participating in the two private virtual economic briefings will have with you very soon. PNC Financial Services Group Chief Economist Gus Fauché with us to talk about it. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.